This is the Food Not Bombs Radio Network.
Across the nation, the summer of 1997 has been a summer of resistance from the streets of New England.
I don't want this project over here. There's too many poor people now that have been pushed out of their apartments in this city that are on the streets. As every time we walk through Central Square, we know who the homeless and the poor are because of the gentrification and because of the loss of rent control. We must stop this project. We must stop it.
All right.
So if you believe and if you're behind me, raise your hand and say, stop it now.
To the Windy City of Chicago.
I think if we understand the history of police abuse, we can see that it has been consistent throughout the years where police attacks have been, under the color of authority, have been committed against people in Black and Latino communities in particular, and working communities in general.
To the slopes of Big Mountain in the Four Corners.
They have been living peacefully with the traditional Hopi now for a very long time. They think up to maybe 1,000 years. And they've intermarried with one another. And the traditional Diné made a pact with the traditional Hopi to protect the land. They see it as their mother, and they don't believe that it should be raped, that it should not be mined and cut open.
To the shores of California.
To look at your beautiful faces and know that his freedom is yours and your freedom is his. And after 27 years of brutal imprisonment, nothing could break this man. And part of it was because you were there. Geronimo G. Jaga.
Coming up on the Food Not Bombs Radio Network, Summer of Resistance, Part 1. Sleepers Awake. August 9th, New York City police sodomized Haitian immigrant Abner Louima with a toilet plunger in a restroom of the 70th Precinct Station. The brutalization sparked marches of thousands of people on the streets of Brooklyn. In Big Mountain, Arizona, 7 remaining Native American families make a last stand against the combined might of the U.S. government and the Peabody Coal Corporation. In the city of Whittier, California, Food Not Bombs activists face up to 6 months in jail and $1,000 fines, yet continue to serve food to homeless people. In Boston and San Francisco, the Food Not Bombs offshoot group, Homes Not Jails, takes over abandoned buildings, moving homeless and underhoused people into them. As significant as these occurrences may seem, they actually represent only a small number of the total acts of resistance which have taken place across the North American continent during the long, hot summer just ending. In Nashville, Tennessee, protesters burn down a department store after police kill an unarmed black man. In the Northeast, the Kensington Welfare Rights Union completes a 125-mile march from the city of Philadelphia to the doorstep of the United Nations, calling international attention to conditions of poverty in the United States. The march is called the March for Our Lives. The list goes on. In Ottawa, homeless people erect a tent city on a piece of federally owned land called LeBreton Flats. In California, thousands of bicyclists flood into the streets of San Francisco after a mayor's belligerent remarks threatening an end to the monthly ride known as Critical Mass. In Farmington, Pennsylvania, the Children of the Bruderhof launch a children's crusade to death row aimed at ending capital punishment in America. While all across America, from sea to shining sea, thousands upon thousands of people rejoice at the release from prison of long-incarcerated Black Panther leader Elmer Geronimo Jijaga.
So let us try to etch these moments into our memories, because we will have to draw upon this moment as we welcome Geronimo back into the struggle.
Are these just isolated, aberrant occurrences, or are they symptomatic of a growing groundswell for radical change in America? I'm Richard Edmondson. You're listening to the Food Not Bombs radio network, and this is part one of a special four-part series entitled Summer of Resistance.
Oh, to the people, Mandela, Mandela, the Ceramos, hasta la victoria siempre. Mandela, hello. All right.
When Geronimo Jijaga walked out on stage in front of an audience of 3,000, there occurred a spontaneous outpouring of warmth, possibly unparalleled to anything ever witnessed in the auditorium of Mission High School in San Francisco. The hall was filled to capacity, with additional overflow crowds being seated in the school cafeteria, where sound was piped in over the school PA system.
I hear so much about everybody so happy that I'm out. And you gotta understand that I struggle, movement is struggling. So many are struggling. But a lot of people don't understand that why are so many people responding like this to Geronimo. And I tell them because they were a part of these 27 years that I did a very important part, Sante. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, because it was you who should be applauding yourselves for the courageous, audacious, at times audacious, support that you gave me and so many others, San Quentin Six, I see someone right there, throughout the years, and when no one would even touch us, when no one would even be associated with the name Geronimo or Joyce Jackson or David Johnson or Sunday Ada Lewilly Tate or Bato Telement, Talamantes, Louis Talamantes, Rochelle McGee, and it was you who stood up very courageously and defied the powers that be and supported us in such ways that we were able to survive some of the worst forms of torture that you can ever imagine. And so I want to applaud you, say thanks. Thank you very much for all you've done.
When Jijaga emerged from prison on June 10th, he made it a priority to work for the release of other political prisoners in the United States. A target of the FBI's COINTELPRO operations against the Black Panther Party in the 60s, Jijaga was imprisoned unjustly for 27 years for a murder he did not commit. On August 16th, he spoke at an evening in solidarity with Pennsylvania's death row journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal. The evening raised $20,000 for Abu-Jamal's legal defense.
And we were talking the other day about when Mumia came to national headquarters, right after we had started the chapter in Philadelphia, and how he stood out, being such a young, precocious brother who was always willing to participate, willing to help. Such a beautiful, I mean, you could feel people. You can understand from that feeling that these people have a humanity that's so deep, so vast, that there's certain things that you won't even question that they would not do. And Mumia was one of those young brothers. We all call him our little brother. Emory is sitting right over there. Emory Douglas. I don't know if David is in the house. David, hear you? We all feel very strongly about Mumia's position and so many others, but tonight we want to talk about Mumia because he's such a selfless and always have been such a selfless soul.
Also speaking that evening were Leonard Wineglass, Abu-Jamal's chief attorney, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Alice Walker, and a host of others. But the star attraction was Jijaga. Jijaga is a Vietnam combat veteran who later, in returning home from Southeast Asia, became Minister of Defense of the L.A. chapter of the Black Panther Party. The year was 1969. On December 4th, just 4 days after the COINTELPRO assassination of party leader Fred Hampton in Chicago, the Los Angeles police launched a raid against L.A. Panther headquarters. During the 5-hour armed siege which followed, the L.A. Panthers, under Jijaga's leadership, withstood all of the firepower at the LAPD's disposal and emerged after having suffered no casualties. On August 5th, 1997, Jijaga, along with wife Ashaki, granted an interview to Bay Area radio host Kilu Niyasha. During the interview, Jijaga expressed his belief in and support for a matriarchal society.
I fight for a matriarchal structure, and everybody knows DC and I always was very open about that. Mm-hmm. That no one in the world, I'm fighting for anything that's going to be led by a man. And I'm serious about that because
right.
I believe that we come from women. And I know that the sperm fertilizes. But I know that the woman goes through this labor process. And everyone knows that, so I know it. But, and I know that what I can say, that we also go through a labor process. Some people call it sympathy pregnancy or whatever. But I've experienced it. But to me, the true essence is understood and better understood in the feminine gender, the feminine world, the feminine reality. And I based that on my experiences throughout life and my readings that, and my knowing women that you are more loving. You are more what we would want a society to be. Whereas men seem to be more, and I'm a man,
towards destructive things, and I'm trying to be as critical as I can be, as, you know, as honest in my self-criticism. A lot of men don't like to admit that. So sure, I would love to see a society that's led by women, because women love the children. Women nurture us. Men, we have a tendency to wander off, and the baby is born, and a woman is not going to leave that baby. The woman is going to stay with it. You know, there are so many arguments for this, but it's kind of, a lot of people say it's kind of too, it's premature. But I don't think so.
I've read where matriarchal societies of old, ancient matriarchal societies, were peaceful, harmonious. Mm-hmm.
And they were the first societies, right? They were matriarchal. Yeah, because back then, well, we don't know, but they say they didn't know about the fertilization process. So the woman was looked on; she was deified, but she was looked on as a god. This is how life was coming, and whoever gives life is God.
Mother nature.
Yeah, mother. So the woman was the godhead, the god figure of society. All of the children kept the woman's lineage, not the father lineage, which recently came about, historically speaking, when the Romans, Europeans pulled what's called a societal coup against the women. And then all of a sudden, women became slaves of the man, yeah. And all of the children became slaves of these men.
Perhaps one thing you'd never find in a matriarchal society is capital punishment. This is Leonard Wineglass, lead counsel for Mumia Abu-Jamal, outlining the formidable obstacles standing in the way of his client's path to freedom.
And where are we now? We're now before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And we're asking the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to overrule Judge Szabo and grant Mumia finally a new trial. Pennsylvania Supreme Court is an elected court. They run for office and they run for re-election. They run with the active support and the financial support of the powerful 30,000-member Fraternal Order of the Police Union. A vote for Mumia is a vote against the police. Philadelphia attorneys tell me that these judges are not deciding a case when they decide Mumia's case. They're making a career decision. If they vote for Mumia, they're finished. And so we don't expect much, but we're going to hear from them this year. And we anticipate that they're going to uphold Judge Szabo in the face of all this. And we anticipate that the present governor of Pennsylvania, Governor Tom Ridge, who has already gone on record and promised that as soon as the Supreme Court acts, he will set a new date for Mumia's execution.
And I can attest personally to the fact that death rows are not anything to laugh about. 18 months on San Quentin's death row was, and I was in Vietnam twice and Senator Man, it was one of the most horrible experiences of my life. And I know what Mumia is going through back there. I've been through prisons all over the country. And I know a lot of you have also. If not, you better get ready for it because of what they're doing if you don't take a stand against the villain of prisons. But back to Mumia, he's under a lot of stress, the most stress you can imagine.
Governor Ridge is a very sensitive man. He almost became Bob Dole's running mate. But he served in Vietnam as a sharpshooter in the I Corps at about the same time as My Lai. And he was a tough, two-fisted Republican prosecutor in a rural county seeking the death penalty and ran on a death penalty platform when he ran for governor. So we don't expect much there.
Y'all don't understand, we didn't join the movement to go in prison or to die and then turn around and say, you owe me, I did for you. We didn't join like that. We joined to give our lives. We joined to be sacrificial lambs, if you will, to just, I mean, all the way dedicated to these principles that people should be free. We should not have any slavery. We should not have any rich, filthy rich corporation manipulating society and putting people in a position where this guy's going to end up in prison and this guy's going to walk because he got $5 million. It's capitalism. It's wrong. It's some of the worst forms of social brutality ever you can ever find in the annals of history.
Where do we think we would always win this case? In the federal courts. The federal courts of the United States have, since 1977, reversed 40% of all the death cases that come to them. There wouldn't be 3,100 on death row now. There'd be 5,000. And that fact was not lost on the pro-death penalty forces in the Congress. And after the Oklahoma City bombing, and Congress was asked to pass an anti-terrorism bill, they tacked on to the anti-terrorism bill an amendment called the Effective Death Penalty Act. And that act effectively removes from the jurisdiction of these federal judges the right to conduct an independent review of these state death penalty cases. And so the place where we thought Mumia would finally get a full and fair hearing has been taken from us by virtue of this 1996 Effective Death Penalty Act bill, which President Clinton signed.
We joined the movement to make it work, to win what's right, and that's what we're dedicated for. So Mumia, Sekou, Mutulu, I mean, I can name on and on and on. Mufundi, we can go down south. I'm from Louisiana. We can name Wood Fox, Redu. I did time with most of them. We could talk about Guatilas, Leonard Peltier. We call them Guatilas. It's our spiritual. You know, from the Haudenosaunee. We had basic native classes, just like we had Mexican history classes, African history classes. You have a very educated element behind those walls now that's worthy of your support. And once you get them out here, you're going to see what I'm talking about. You're going to see some very beautiful sisters and brothers that's going to contribute so much to our movement. And that's why they got them in there. They don't call them political prisoners for nothing.
And then he imposed on Mumia the lawyer who said he was unprepared. And that lawyer immediately asked to be released. And the judge said, no, you're going to try the case. This is the opening day of the trial, plus 1.5 days. This lawyer testified in 1995 that he tried this case without talking to a single witness, that he had not read all of the documents, that he was utterly unprepared, and indeed he tried 3 times to be excused from the case after he was ordered to proceed.
And for years, everyone knew I didn't commit this murder, but the pigs did not want to relent. They knew it also. So in Mumia's case, the community know that Mumia didn't do that murder. We know Mumia didn't do that murder, just like everybody knew I didn't do no murder. But the pigs don't want to recognize it because they don't care whether Mumia or Geronimo did a murder or not. They got us, and they are going to continue to manipulate the truth, whether we did it or not. They know we didn't do it. So that should show you right there who you're dealing with. You're dealing with some heartless devils, some dogs who don't give a damn about a person's guilt or innocence. All they care about is promoting themselves.
Mumia's gun was a legal weapon. He had a permit. He applied for it. He had been robbed several times. Like all cab drivers working through the night in Philadelphia, he had a gun. But what was not presented to the jury was the fact in the autopsy report, the doctor who removed the bullet from the officer's brain, which was the fatal bullet, noted specifically in the report that the bullet was a .44 caliber bullet. Mumia's gun was a .38 caliber gun. You cannot shoot a .44 caliber bullet with a .38 caliber gun. Well, wasn't that persuasive? The answer is no, because the jury never heard that. Mumia's lawyer never read the autopsy report.
Virtually unknown to the American public is the fact that many political prisoners in the United States are Puerto Rican nationalists who have fought for independence. Most Americans have at least heard the names Mumia Abu-Jamal, Leonard Peltier, and Geronimo Gigaga. But how many have ever heard of Alejandrina Torres or Luis Rosa? Although it's never been acknowledged by the U.S. government, many Puerto Rican prisoners are technically, under international law, regarded as prisoners of war. Mike Thornton of station KVMR spoke with Josefina Rodriguez, who is the mother of two young Puerto Rican prisoners, both women, Lucy and Alicia Rodriguez.
First of all, people have to understand that Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States. First, it was a colony from Spain for 400 years, and Puerto Ricans always fought for its independence. And when Spain gave Puerto Rico its independence in 1897, a year later, in 1898, the United States invaded Puerto Rico militarily. So the struggle for Puerto Rico's independence never stopped. And we see these prisoners as a continuation of that struggle. Many people around the world recognize that they are freedom fighters and they are respected and for what they mean to fight for the liberation of your country. And they have the love for the people. They have the respect from very prominent people. And people from religious sectors, a very high level of respected people from the church, different denominations, 11 Peace Prize winners have been sent a letter signed by 11 of those people, including Loretta Scott King and Desmond Tutu, and people like that sent President Clinton a letter.
Lucy and Alicia are serving 80-plus year sentences at the Federal Prison for Women in Dublin, California.
And if this bill is not overturned by the United States Supreme Court, and it will be challenged, then Mumia indeed will face a very serious situation, a situation that can only be responded to effectively by you.
Coming up on our next program, Summer of Resistance Part 2, Taking It to the Streets, with Food Not Bombs, Homes Not Jails, bicycle riders, welfare protesters, marijuana activists, and others.
Y'all ready for some revolution?
So, basically, in L.A. County, it's illegal to cook out of your homes and give it to a homeless person.
Well, you better be, because that's the only thing that's going to turn this system around.
That's coming up next time on Summer of Resistance Part 2, Taking It to the Streets on the Food Not Bombs Radio Network. All four parts of our Summer of Resistance series are available on cassette for $18. Make your check payable to the Food Not Bombs Radio Network, 750 La Playa, L.A., capital P, L-A-Y-A, Box 852, San Francisco, California, 94121. That's the Food Not Bombs Radio Network, 750 La Playa, L-A-P-L-A-Y-A, Box 852, San Francisco, California, 94121. We'd like to thank Kilu Niyasha of Freedom is a Constant Struggle and Mike Thornton of station KVMR for their contributions to this program. We'd also like to acknowledge, with great appreciation, the financial assistance of the Burlington, Vermont chapter of Food Not Bombs. The music on this program is by Anti-Flag. For the Food Not Bombs Radio Network, I'm Richard Edmondson.